But yeah, there are definitely tough cash spots that we were in. I would say that the scariest overarching thing was probably that there weren't real-time exchanges for a while. And you're just sitting, we were sitting there with a bunch of tech and a bunch of engineers. And it's like, is this going to happen?
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello and welcome to Paleo EdTech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce. And we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From double click to double verify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
This week, we are very happy to welcome Michael Provenzano to the show. Michael is the CEO and co-founder of Vistar Media, which delivers digital out-of-home solutions. But back in 2007, Michael was the co-founder of Invite Media, the first real demand-side platforms, and it was arguably the first enterprise platform for scaled programmatic media buyers. Invite was acquired by Google in 2010 and became the basis for its dominant DSP, now called DV360. After that, Michael co-founded Vistar to bring programmatic methods to out-of-home. So both Invite and Vistar were based in Philadelphia. What's so great about Philadelphia?
Good question. Went to school in Philadelphia. So, Invite was started when we were coming out of our junior years of college. So it was really a geographic constraint to education was actually the source of it. And funny enough, one of the early engineers of Invite, Mark Chadwick, is my co-founder at Vistar. And if you ever meet Mark, Mark is a live or die Philly guy.
Yeah, but all things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
Which is a lot of Philly guys, I think. When we started working on Vistar, he was like, I live in Philly and I'm going to live in Philly. And so I was like, well, we'll build engineering in Philly again. Here we go.
Here we are. And when you were there, did you have any career aspirations? Did you have a plan?
I was actually a track athlete. So all I thought about going into college was, going to, national championships and trying to win in sprinting as a 5'6" man. You're not going to win that game, but something deep in me thought I could win.
So when you made your way out of college, where did your career take you?
We started Invite when we were in college. So, we were wrapping up junior years and we'd gotten together. And I was actually looking for an internship that summer, funny enough. And some guys I had met through the year, and we'd kind of generated ideas. We had this little like nerdy club of talking about entrepreneurship. And we had gotten together, and there were two of the guys, Nat and Zach, super successful entrepreneurs, had said, hey, they won like a Wharton business plan competition for, I think it was like dynamic creative ads or something. And this summer, we're going to work on this idea and run with it. And so me and another guy joined them in that endeavor going into the summer. So really, I started working and then building a startup business and attempting to have a senior year of college. So that was work. That was the beginning of the work.
Were there a lot of juniors in college at that time who were aware of ad tech and the concept of programmatic advertising?
Well, yeah. So that year, programmatic really wasn't a thing. So that's
it was one a bit of, early.
Yeah. Specifically, I think the shortcut to that question really is Nat, one of the founders. He had done a internship the year before, I believe, at a company called Video Egg, which was, I think, an early video ad network, basically, one of the earlier ones. And so he had that, experience in advertising. So that's kind of where this sourced from.
Was the vision for Invite from the beginning what it ended up being, the demand side platform?
No, the story's pretty funny. And I've told some folks a few times, and people listen, they're like, really? That's not as cool as we thought it was going to be. Like I said, we started, it's kind of a dynamic creative idea. And then I remember school ending junior year, and we go into the summertime. We all moved into like this kind of crappy, kind of warehousey looking apartment we all lived in for the summer. And we were maybe like a week in to this, working on this project. And then Facebook released its apps. This is like 2007. So, or eight, maybe, I forget. But they had released their apps and we're like, oh, let's build Facebook apps. So literally in the first week, we changed what we were doing as a business. We did have an idea that we'd build an ad server on top of these apps that could make decisions based on people's profiles and all this type of stuff. And so, yeah, we pivoted and then kind of spent the summer doing that. And in the middle of the summer, the funny part of the whole thing is a recruiter introduced us to Brian O'Kelly, obviously very well known in the ad tech space. In Brian fashion, he kind of said, you know, you guys are idiots. You should build the first bidder. I'm building the first real-time exchange. All the future of programmatic is going to be, you have supply side, you have demand side, and those are going to be bifurcated. And we're like, oh, this guy sounds smart. It sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So funny enough, that is actually how. It's a very odd situation where you have young people kind of given an idea and we execute it. And usually it's the opposite. It's usually young people with some idea that's crazy, and then they hire a bunch of talent to execute on it.
So he was just coming, Brian O'Kelly was just coming off of the Right Media acquisition.
Yeah.
And I guess he was thinking of AppNexus at this time, sort of dreaming up AppNexus. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So it was AdNexus, I believe, when he started it. He actually had to launch like a hosting company. He was running his own hosting business. That was like one of the centerpiece things I think he was allowed to work on or something. There's so many convoluted stories around that. But he was already working on, you know, his next big thing, which turned out to be a very big thing.
Well, last week we had Ari Lewine on, and he was working at AdNexus.
Right.
He was there. That's where he met his co-founders.
That's right.
Everything traces them back somehow to Brian O'Kelly. So the recruiter, were they trying to recruit you to AdNexus?
No, I don't know. I don't know what they wanted. I actually don't even remember.
They wanted something.
Yeah, no, I don't remember why that. I think we were recruiting. I think it was our recruiter. And they're like, yeah, you should meet this guy. And we're like, yeah.
The pivot then to the demand side platform, did you have to get smart all of a sudden on the industry? And how did you learn about what you needed to do?
There was this idea, right, of real-time bidding. There was an idea that there would be a bifurcation of the buy and sell side, but that didn't really exist. We joke a lot because we built a bidder and there was nothing really to bid on. There was AppNexus and that was it. And it was like, well, are other people going to come to this party? And we actually had implemented a pretty hacked together, like fake kind of bidding that was going with Right Media, where we'd sync campaigns between our quote bidder to Right Media, just to have the scale and to be able to actually do something for customers in the early days. And it was funny, and then it probably was 2009, maybe end of 2009 or middle, Google released AdX, Full Blast, OpenRTB, then I believe AdECN, what became prevalent, and AdMeld, and all of these guys started having that real-time supply. It kind of all came quickly. And then it was like, wow, this was a good idea. To have this bidder that can plug in all this stuff. This is a great idea. And then Right Media was kind of a flip. It was like, well, now Right Media is the annoying thing to buy because it wasn't an open RTB. It wasn't automated. And so we kind of shifted all the things over to this new marketplace that was existing on the now SSP side.
Was AppNexus an investor?
Brian was an investor at one point. And then when they went competitive, because originally I think they were pure SSP, if I recall. And then when they started building a DSP business, I believe he pulled and said, hey, you know, this is a conflict of interest. So at one point he was an investor in the business.
How did you guys go about getting, you know, investors overall? Was it hard to raise money at that time?
Good question. I mean, I can't take a ton of credit for it. You know, one of my founders at the time, I think today most people would consider him a fundraising master and genius and across the ecosystem, not just ad tech, but in entrepreneurship in general, Nat Turner. And I think, you know, Nat had actually worked at First Round Capital as an intern, or I guess summer internship or something. That was one of our first investors, were the guys at First Round Capital, and a few other angels that kind of we had met through the ad tech space. But I personally can't take the glam. I'd say we definitely had some breaking of responsibility, and Nat was the king of that. But it, you know, Nat was able to woo people even during some of the economic downturns. And I think people do like a young entrepreneur story, even if it's a bad idea. And ad tech had done well at that time, right? I mean, people saw multi-$100 million acquisitions happening, like, oh, there's something going on here. It wasn't like the days of like Rocket Fuel Public when shit was hitting the fan, right? Like very different landscape.
What were your first offices like? Where were they?
Oh God. At Invite, our first office was in Northern Liberties, Philadelphia, which is really cool now and very hip and very nice. Was not as nice. And my current co-founder would tell you, I'm trying to think the word I should use on this podcast. You guys are preppy little weak Pin kids, you can't handle Philly, you know, kind of, that was the message we got. Well, we definitely couldn't handle that part of Philly. So it was a little rough in the neighborhood. We didn't leave the vicinity of this apartment very often. But that was the first one. And then, you know, once the school year started, we actually got a kind of a townhome in Center City. Actually, it was a cool, like, kind of place that we got to build out of like a residential area. And it was kind of this great little story, and became like, I don't know, quite the emotional attachment to that place across the whole company. It was like, oh, that we built this company in a 2-floor apartment, you know?
It's awesome. What was the culture like?
Oh, God. Probably would have gotten sued today, if I had to guess.
Toga, 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 toga.
It was frat-like.
Yeah, like 45 people, 2 women in administrative roles, no HR, all guys, horrifying. Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, today it's like, and now I look back and it's pretty funny because the majority of my leadership team is female. So it's pretty funny. It's like, that's where I came from and here I am today. And I think it's just ridiculous that we were what we are, but honestly, I don't know, some people we'd interview come in and look at this place and just be like, oh my God, like, I cannot work with these boys.
It's not going to be an orgy. It's a toga party.
It's pretty horrifying. Yeah, that's the nicest word I've heard for it ever. I think there was like Smirnoff challenges at the time. So let's just say those icing challenges were happening on a weekly basis at that office.
Who are some of your early customers?
Early guys were on the ad network side, actually. I think you have to have a certain acumen to pick up agencies. And our big agency pickup was kind of the beginning of Vivekey Publicis, actually. So they were building that trading desk from scratch and the concept of a trading desk at the time. And we got to be that on the ground floor of building, I guess, really, I think, from to my knowledge of history, is one of the first trading desks with them. But before that, the early clients were pretty much all ad networks. So you had people who were running ad network businesses on Right Media or something. They wanted more control. They wanted technology. They didn't want to have to do everything by hand a bit. And so we really gave them a place to be like, hey, here's a, you know, 10% fee, 20%, 12%, I think was our average fee on the DSP. It was like, log in and knock yourself out, guys. And that was really, Right Media had some pretty good settings around that too. I can't discount that it wasn't pretty self-service. It was a little harder to use, and you had to connect with your own supply sources, you know, slider on which exchanges you want to plug into, and you could just hit it and go. And I think that was probably pretty differentiated for these guys, having that transparency, that instantaneous reporting. Now we take all this stuff for granted, but I think at the time, the ad networks were really looking for power user tools. And I'd say that's where the beginning really started on the client base.
Were there marketers or advertisers, brands themselves, who got interested in using a DSP themselves, or was it all through agencies and networks?
I think it's safe to say that kind of the in-housing concept came later. I don't think in our time as just Invite solo independent we ever saw that. You still had to work with clients closely, but it still came through the agency, most of these deals. I think maybe we had a few specific clients that might have been like relationship-based brand direct that we had done, but it was still IO business. It wasn't like a self-service brand logging in. That was a stretch, I think, for that time period.
Yeah, because we're still in 2008, 2009, right around then, right?
Exactly. Yeah. People are still learning. The word programmatic just got created, kind of thing, right? Like DSP, right. Like you're walking into an agency, you're like, we're a DSP. And they're like, what is that?
were there any moments in Invite Media's story where you thought you weren't going to make it? Like you might go out of business, or did you have any near-death experiences that we hear from entrepreneurs who survived the dot-com bust?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you got to run a startup if you didn't feel like shit a few nights, right?
Definitely not. Dark moments.
Okay. Yeah, you always do. I mean, you know, there was cash flow worries, you know, definitely running into like, hey, I think we're going to be profitable. And oh no, I said that 4 months ago and I'm not sure if I still think that. So, you know, we ran the line a few times. I do remember edges on payroll for sure. We're just like, well, I don't know how many more of these buttons I can click. We're going to run out of cash to send these payrolls. So there are definitely moments where we were pretty tight on cash and debating between, you know, we had about to cross that line of profitability. And it's like, do you staff up? What do you do at this moment? Obviously, you know, in the time of the early Google conversations and other corp dev conversations that had come even before Google, it was, you know, it starts throwing you off path. You start getting distracted. You're like, oh, well, it doesn't even matter. We don't need to make money. We're going to get bought tomorrow. And when you're 21, you say that pretty much every day. It's a little different, but yeah, there are definitely tough cash spots that we were in. I would say that the scariest overarching thing was probably that piece that I mentioned earlier, which is like, there weren't real-time exchanges for a while. And you're just sitting, we were sitting there with a bunch of tech and a bunch of engineers. And it's like, is this going to happen? You know, like, or is it, we're gonna wait this out for a few more years? And if so, how much money do we need to do that? Because right now we're just kind of a sinking system onto Right Media, which is not a business.
Did you consult with Brian O'Kelly throughout, or did he advise you technically?
Yeah, I mean, the team was in constant contact with Brian. One, because they were the exchanged DSP connection, one, but that right. There was also, before they were competing, there was an advisory capacity, of course.
So he didn't just give you the idea and say good luck?
No. There are a lot of interactions with Brian and the team over years.
Yeah. Yeah. And then other DSPs appeared, MediaMath, DataZoo. Who were the main competitors on your radar in the beginning?
The biggest was Turn at the time. They actually sent us a lawsuit within the final months of the company. They hated us. We'd taken two great people, or two or three maybe great people from their company on the hiring side. They were pissed. They tried to sue us. They were really real competitor. I mean, that was a real business. They had really good people working there. They were scary. They were like a real threat. They had pivoted from an ad network to a DSP pretty quickly. MediaMath, less so. I mean, I remember we sold the business and then like Terminal 1 got released and they were running spreadsheets all the way up till then. So like we had already built the whole software platform and, you know, they had just released theirs and we'd sold to Google and it was like, well, that's a little late to the game. So that, I think there were some folks that were fake it to the make it on the tech side. And then of course, MediaMath became a powerful tech hub of the industry and has done really well. But at the time it was, we had been too early and then therefore we were in the lead on a lot of the tech side in those early days. But those are the main ones that it's been a while, so I'm trying to think who else was there at that time. But I remember losing sleep on Turn for sure.
You mentioned Google. What ultimately led to the conversations with Google?
They're pretty forward. I mean, they just said, we believe that this kind of bifurcated market is going to grow. We're going to start acquiring businesses in the space. It's either you, MediaMath, or Turn. What would you like to do? And it's kind of like, well, 21 years old. So guess what we would like to do?
Absolutely not.
And we had a pretty clean business, right? We hadn't raised Series Q financing or anything crazy. It was pretty easy. 45 people. That's one of the nastiest things I've learned in corp dev side of things is just like, how many bodies are you buying? And you got to interview all these people. You got to make sure it's a good cultural fit. And it's going to blend in. And it's like buying 45 people for a company like Google is not, you can sneeze at that kind of thing at this point. But yeah, it was an easier buy than probably most things. And we did have tech and we did have some key trading desk relationships, which I think was a big attractor for them.
Yeah. Ultimately, what do you think the impact on Google's business was, that deal?
I mean, I think it was a really good deal for them. the number was somewhere between, I don't know, 70 and 90 or something was the final deal price. And I mean, obviously the code's changed since we wrote it, right? It's not the same. DV360 is not what Invite was, of course. But I mean, it was the start of, I don't know, $10 billion a year of display. Now, we won't only display, we didn't do video at the time, but you know, to display and video now and mobile. I think it's pretty good ROI. There are people who criticize us, like, you guys sold out too early. And it's like, whatever. I don't know. I get over it, whatever.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. Because we did talk to Oren Hoffman, who said he did sell too early, sold LiveRamp too early. Not to Google, but he just sold.
I don't agree with that.
So 2010, Google acquires Invite Media. What happened then? Did you think that you would work for Google? Did the management team become Google employees?
Yeah, I remember when we became Google employees, I decided to step away early on. So we had kind of talked internally of like, what is there to do at this next phase? And particularly for me, I wanted to actually do something not ad tech related at the time. Funny enough, where I am today. At the time, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And the feedback from Google was like, well, we need everyone focused on this. So I was like, well, I'm going to go elsewhere. So I ducked out early on. Some folks stayed for a year, some 2 years, some 3 years. Some are still there today. We have some Invite people who are still high up in the ad division. We have some people who moved to Google Cloud. A lot of entrepreneurs came out of it it's fun to see some of the guys. We probably don't hang out as much as we should, but.
The decision to step away and do something outside of ad tech, what drove that? Were you just tired of late nights and ad tech?
I don't know. I think it's kind of your classic.
Some variety.
Yeah, super young, just like, oh, I want to do something else because I want to do something else. Like, I probably could have sat on that idea for like 4 months and said, I should just take a big salary, sit here and do nothing.
What was the idea?
It wasn't. I actually went traveled. I lived in Italy for like 3 months and like just helped my brother-in-law launch a bar in like a small town in Texas. And the following year, I tried to start a few businesses in recruiting. And I don't know. I think it was just like that garage entrepreneur. Like, you don't know. I don't think I knew at that age how to live another way. I'm like, oh, like we got to eat crappy sandwiches for lunch every day and sleep in an air mattress. Like that's life, right? I think it's a little bit of that.
So you weren't risk averse, clearly.
I don't get qualified as that too much.
So where did the idea for Vistar come from?
Yeah, it was one of our co-founders at the time. He's no longer with the business, but you know, it was a friend of mine from college, and he had said like, hey, I kind of get the high levels of what you get at an Invite. I get the value of programmatic at a broad level. And I think there's an opportunity to look at other channels and say, well, that's a valid logic, right? Like TV, radio, at home, there's a handful of channels that are going to have to become, even if you don't use the word programmatic, they're going to have to become data-driven, automated, measurable, right? Every channel has to go that direction at some point. Yeah, I think that logic was very sound because, you know, here we are today. It's been a really successful business, but it was a lot more work than I think expected to get an old school industry on the move.
What were the big challenges about revolutionizing out of home?
Oh, man. A lot of it's human related, right? It's a cultural shift. I mean, we would walk in early rooms on both the buy side and the sell side and say, you know, sellers, hey, we want to monetize your inventory through programmatic. And they're like, what is that? Stone face. Like, what did you just say to me? Like, what did you call me? You know, then they go online, they read an article and it's like, oh, this is race to the bottom. This is horrible for my business. I don't want to do this. And it's like, well, read the article about online video, not online display. And then you'll learn more about the economics. And then on the buy side, it was, hey, no, I mean, we buy these billboards and this is what we do every day. We don't need a computer to help us, you know, do that. It was, it took a lot of explaining and work around like, well, it's not just about computer. It's about smarter ways of planning. It's about actually showing ROI post campaign, not just I bought the board, I did the job. We did a lot of hard work, in those early years, and still have to do some pretty heavy lifting today. But definitely feeling the benefits of your point, the scalability of it, and that the industry group has grown very slowly. Like if you look at the CAGR of out of home, it's like 2% or something, and the out-of-home investment growing at 1% a year, 2% a year, it's horrible. That's not a good business. There's nowhere, no one should be bragging about that growth rate. And this is a national, by the way, not just local, but a national advertisers, that's not a bragging right. And it's very clear that, you know, why does Google make so much money, Facebook, et cetera, on advertising? Well, you know, there's a formula to it. And that goes back to that data-driven, automated, measurable. If you can bring those just three simple core elements to any channel, you really can drive for one, further adoption in the media and just growth of spend, but also recurring business.
Were there learnings that you applied from your experience at Invite at Vistar? Anything you did differently the second time?
Tech-wise, for sure. Yeah, we definitely had it. You know, Mark and I, Mark was, and his engineer, and him and I, we both kind of we're doing a lot of firefighting at Invite, kind of first time running it through. And, every week there's a fire to put out. And so a lot of the most like tactical things we learned day one was like building quality software, building process around testing, and not overcommitting to customers and just building shiny objects and then hoping they work in the end. So we just took a more methodical approach, like a more mature perhaps approach to how you develop software, how you release software. And so I would say that's one of our strongest suits as a business even today is that stability piece. So we definitely took that. And something that I had to learn, I think, as an engineer by background, is it's not all about a computer. And especially when I move from digital out of home, it's heavily people and relationship oriented. So, I think I shifted a lot of my life from let me spend my nights deep on a laptop digging through code and cool things we can build, and let me make sure I go get drinks and dinner with people and entertain and spend time with other humans. So that was those were both, I'd say, ad tech wake-up calls if you want to be successful in this space.
Where were your offices this time around?
Oh, man. Oh, gosh. Similar Philly Row.
House?
Or yes, yeah, well, Philly Row home to start, and then we got some other properties throughout Center City and Old City in Philly for the engineering team. And then in New York, as you know, the real estate is a little expensive. So started off in one of these shared offices that kind of goes down in history. I think a lot of early clients saw this office and almost didn't work with us because there was this office that was also shared by maybe like five or six other startups. It was mixed with, there was like a photo studio there. So some days there'd be like lingerie shoots and then like everyone's out with their laptops like, oh, I got to work outside my table today. And then you come in on a Friday morning and they had thrown a party there on a Thursday night and there's like cocaine in the bathroom. And you're like, oh, well, this is work. Cool. All right.
That's good. Cool. Dust that off.
Yeah. And be like people passed out on like the couch. And I've got like a multi-billion-dollar publisher coming in the door that morning. Be like, well, let me just scoot this body out of the way and we'll just have our meeting about my startups.
I assume. You left that office eventually.
We did.
You're not there now.
Okay. We generated the revenue to upgrade our life to something easier. Nice.
So this last year and a half, then obviously we had a pandemic and probably had an impact on your business. How did you guys handle that? And are you bouncing back? Do you have optimistic news for our listeners?
I've been very blunt and transparent about this piece. I actually did a little bit of talking on AdExchanger about this a while ago. And, yeah. You know, we got hit by a, you know, full on train, right? Like I mean, at a home when you can't go out of the home. I mean, it's pretty basic, right? And we were transparently, we're 85% down year over year in Q2. We were 145 people at our prime and we dropped down all the way to 95. I mean, we really had a massive cultural hit. Massive, like, you know, looking in the mirror for a lot of our employees of like, am I sticking with this thing? Is at home coming back? What's going on? And then, you know, me getting on weekly calls over video, trying to be like, and I'm not really a motivator. I'm not like a very like, energetic person, very monotone. I'm like, don't worry, guys, we still got it. It's like, I don't know how many weeks you can say that, you know? In the back of my mind, I'm like, I don't know if we really got it. This is gonna be a long one. But we made it through Q2, you know, we survived that. Q3 was probably 50% down year over year, which is still not great. But then we finally broke even again on EBITDA coming out of September. We had been EBITDA profitable for like 7.5 years. So it was actually like a really big cultural experience for us because I've talked about EBITDA at this company forever. And that's what everyone thinks about the company is revenue, EBITDA, growth of a healthy business. We don't need all this money. We don't need to raise tons of money. We can stay focused and build a real company here. And that was hard to see, right? With the word EBITDA not being used for a few months because it was negative. And then finally in Q4, we came back, largest grossing quarter ever for the business. Q1 was still that weird vaccination time. So we kind of were fine then. And then Q2, Q3 has been phenomenal. It's been every quarter is a record-breaking quarter. And so yeah, COVID has definitely had these impacts. We kind of know how to react to it and we know how to mentally, more importantly, honestly, mentally prepare ourselves. Because the revenue thing is one thing, but it comes back. We know it rebounds. It's really the mental and the personal side is actually, I think, the most massive impact to not only our business, the industry, but people in the world in general.
Yeah, no doubt. It sounds like you've built the muscle now.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for pain, apparently. So we'll see.
Looking back at the industry, we always like to kind of wrap up with this question. Who can you point to as, you know, folks or organizations, vendors you'd call really influential in ad tech and martech? Who had really big impact on the industry?
You know, you bring up the triple of guys. I do refer to them all the time. You know, they have such a great execution story. Their culture is phenomenal. The people love working there. They have a vision for where they're going. Extremely successful financial metrics. It is a company that a lot of other, not even just ad tech companies, but companies period should look up to and say, that's how you run a business. I think
seems
one thing
like is, maybe Brian O'Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, geez, AppNexus was probably one of the largest software engineering teams in New York at one point, right? He had built a powerhouse there. I mean, everyone was like, that is like the Death Star of, you know, ad tech. Like that thing is everyone's there. Everyone's super smart. You couldn't meet a dumb person who worked there kind of thing. And sometimes they let you know that. you know, from what I again, I'm an outsider, but from what I can tell where it is now and kind of the turnover of bodies and in its current form, it's sad to kind of see actually, because you can see the success stories of acquisition where a product and a team is taken and they become something great even further along, versus like when people take assets and I don't know if destroy them is the right word, but they don't nurture them as well as they could. I'm pretty far away from most online media today. I'm just caught up in my out-of-home dream over here. But the thing that bothers me is I kind of flip through where the value is being added. And I don't mean any offense to anyone who works at these companies or kind of works in these disciplines, but like the whole header bidding thing is so much wasted impression volume. The way that the auction process is turned into is a complete shit show. It doesn't make any sense to me. It sounds like, you know, a bunch of people were mad at Google and they went down this path and now it's just this extremely convoluted thing where, you know, at the end of the day, there should be someone who's trying to maximize yield for you. And there's simple ways to do that. And it doesn't have to be at the cost of every other bidder that's in the marketplace. I personally don't understand why there are verification companies. This is probably super offensive, but I'm gonna say it. I don't get it. Just be an exchange without shitty inventory. Why is there a verification company? It doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, sorry. Just don't work with fake inventory and robots and just, you know. And at home, we don't have this problem, right? Like, it's like, there's not like robots walking around the streets. It's like, oh, we counted that eyeball. Whoops.
Well, there's viewability too, I guess. Oh, did someone have to? Was it visible?
Yeah, there's a visibility.
There's some argument for that.
Or it's like, hey, just don't put an ad down there. That could work too, right? Stop being so picky. Like, just have one ad, not 13, you know? My stupid joke, sometimes I think I'm funny, but my stupid joke about that is like ads, especially an invite, like they are gateways to content, right? You watch a pre-roll ad so I can watch this video. I want to read this article, I need to see this banner. It's a roadblock. Imagine you're walking down the street in New York and then a screen shoots out of the floor and says, you know, watch this before you keep walking down the street. Like, that doesn't happen. So I have had a growing appreciation for like passive media and passive conversations that a brand can have with a consumer at a human level versus, okay, there's a paywall. And then you start seeing publishers evolve and it's like, okay, well, why don't you just sign up for a $2 a month subscription and I'll just give you this without this paywall.
And we would like to thank Julia Douglas for letting us use her music, Julia Douglas with two S's.com.